We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have here in this hour of the program, Mae Barenbaum as our guest. Now, she is head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And once a while, particularly here in the summertime, we have her on the program to talk about bugs. And now we've done a big doubleheader here, bug show. We hope that in the first hour we've gotten all of our extermination questions out of the way. That's why we have Phil on the show. When Mae is here on the program, we try to do something really very different. And that is to, if we can, appreciate insects just because they're really cool. And they're very interesting, and they take strange, unusual forms and live in interesting ways. And the fact of the matter is they're all around us. They're even on us. We don't even know it. They're on us. So insects are very much a big part of the world and nature and our lives. So when Mae is on the program, we just try to talk about insects that way. If there's something that you have seen that you're curious about, if you can give us a description, she may be able to identify it for you. And if you have other kinds of insect-related questions, not extermination ones, insect-related questions, we'll be happy to take them. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you may also send us your questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
I know you had a chance to talk with Phil on the way out. You guys passed the two ships in the night. You passed one another. And you know that we had a couple of questions in the first hour about bed bugs. And I don't know if it was touched off by the fact that here I'm holding in my hand today's science section from the New York Times. Always on Tuesdays, they have a section that has all articles about science. And here right on the front page at the top of the fold, it's a big article about bed bugs. And what's interesting is that it poses some questions that entomologists apparently don't really have an answer to. That is, why it is that it seemed like they virtually vanished. We just didn't see them for decades, apparently. We really didn't see them. And now in the 90s, I guess, they came roaring back. And nobody really knows why they went away, and nobody knows why they came back.
Right. Well, actually, since you mentioned the New York Times, a couple of weeks ago, I wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times at their invitation. I guess my reputation precedes me. I was asked specifically to say something nice about bedbugs, some redeeming aspect of bedbug life that because they had been, I mean, they really are a scourge in New York. And the way I started off the op-ed was to tell the story of the first live bedbug I ever saw. I had actually been on the faculty here for 15 years and, of course, graduate school for 5 years, heard about bedbugs, studied bedbugs, never saw a live one until 1995. And this came to me in a little film canister in a package from Massachusetts, where involved story, the father of a student in Boston who knew my father. My father told her father that I was an entomologist and she was having problems with her secondhand mattress, and she mailed me. I didn't know this person. I opened the package, opened up the phone canister, out walked a bedbug. It was a live bedbug. And I was so thrilled that I showed it to everyone I met that day because I'd never seen one. No one I talked to had ever seen one. Now, like you say, they're cover art on the first page of Science Times, and they are closing down theaters and high-end stores and five-star hotels and everything. You know, they're everywhere, even in unlikely. You'd expect them in big metropolitan areas, but like Columbus, Ohio has been hard hit. And the one, if you want to know what the nice thing I said about bedbugs, there's very little of redeeming interest in their, even in their, the details of their biology. Some of their sexual practices are among the most bizarre in the insect world. But you have to say something good about them. It's that they do not discriminate among humans. So it doesn't matter race, color, creed, religion, ethnic background, socioeconomic status.
They'll bite anybody.
And the other unifying factor is no matter what your political, ethno-religious affiliation is nobody likes them. So it's one opinion that is, you know, universally shared is everyone wants them to go back where they came from. So.
Well, it's interesting because this article quotes someone who is said to be a cockroach expert from Virginia Tech. Do you know Deanie Miller?
Just by name.
Just by name. She also essentially said the same thing in the article. She says, the first time I saw one, a bed bug, that wasn't dated 1957 and mounted on a microscope slide was in 2001. Mm-hmm. So clearly that something's going on, that they were gone, but then they're back. And I'm sure this is something entomologists are thinking about. No answer, though, why it is suddenly we have this explosive return of bedbugs?
Well, it's kind of not as sudden. I mean, it's been building, and there have been lawsuits going back a few years. There was one in a high-end London, I think the Mandarin Palace. There's a 5-star hotel in London. There was a lawsuit a few years ago. It's just sort of creeping up gradually. There are two factors that are very likely involved. One is globalization of travel. People are going everywhere. The other is that where bed bugs have persisted throughout this, you know, little hiatus that we've had in the developed world, in the developing world and elsewhere, they have been hammered by pesticides and have acquired resistance. So the control chemicals that worked well in the 40s and 50s are useless now. So add to that the fact that for a long time they weren't recognized. Nobody expected them. It's like nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition, you know. Nobody expects the resurgence of bedbugs. But in this context, another creature that I had never seen, despite, you know, 5 years of graduate school and 10, I'd probably been on the faculty probably 10 years or more here before I actually saw a live head louse. Growing up, I remember we had to take health in eighth grade, and we had a textbook for our health class, which actually turned out to be very useful because someone who had had the textbook before me had penciled in all the naughty words for the human reproductive organs, which I hadn't even known until then. So I learned them in eighth grade thanks to health. But the health textbook had a section on head lice, and we just cracked up because nobody in Carl Sandburg Junior High School in Levittown, Pennsylvania, had ever heard of anyone having head lice. And it is another scourge that was gone and now is back. Almost entirely, I mean, it's hard to demonstrate, you know, conclusively, but pesticide resistance is almost certainly involved because the control chemicals that worked in all those in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, led to the selection for resistance, and now we have very few chemical tools left to manage these guys.
Yeah. That's certainly one of the things that Phil, I don't want to get back into the extermination thing, but we've talked about this before with Phil, and he says one of the problems is that control for bedbugs is difficult, and you have to approach it on a number of dimensions. There's a lot of different things that you need to do. You just can't apparently go in there and just spray some stuff and say, okay, we're done.
Particularly if your neighbors aren't doing the same thing.
Yes, it gets very complicated. So, we'll keep watching the figuratively, I hope, we'll keep watching the bedbugs. We have some callers, and let's get to them. And, maybe real quick, we can do this one. Someone called in just off the air and saying, what do bedbug bites look like? Do you know what they look like?
Yeah, actually, bedbug bites are characteristically often in groups of three. They call them breakfast, lunch, and dinner because they feed for about 3 minutes,
okay.
3 to 10 minutes each blood meal. And the bed bugs are stealth feeders. They are not like horse flies or stable flies that basically punch a hole in you and are very persistent and lap up blood as it flows freely. They have sort of hypodermic syringe-like mouth parts which can be easily occluded by a clot. So bite, they use their sharp, piercing, sucking mouth parts to, in one tube, they inject an anesthetic and an anticoagulant, and the other they use to suck up the blood. So they really don't wake you up, which is, of course, important to their success. When you wake up in the morning, then particularly if it's a heavy infestation, they are distributed all over. Flea bites tend to be aggregated around the ankles, Mosquito bite. Again, you can kind of, chigger bites are around places where clothing is constricted. So bed bugs attack while you're helpless and immobile and prone. So every part of you is accessible. So it's, but those clusters of three are quite characteristic.
Okay. Now I'm feeling very itchy.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. We'll talk with someone first in Robinson, line four, toll free line. Hello.
Good morning, David and May.
Hi.
Let's get out of the bedroom for a while and out into the garden, which is my concern. Tomato hornworms. I have a row of four giant tomato plants of different varieties, all intertwined and brushing one against the other. Yesterday I found my first tomato hornworm, a great big green guy, and I got him off and squished him. Now, I was going to say an urban legend. I should perhaps say it's a suburban legend that only one hornworm will be on one plant.
That's not a scientific thing. It really entirely depends on the size of the host plant. Typically, you know, they didn't grow up eating. Their technical name is actually tobacco hornworm. There's two species in this genus Manduca. The tobacco hornworm is Manduca sexta, which is actually the one you most frequently find on tomatoes. The tomato hornworm is a different species called Manduca quinquimaculata. So you almost assuredly have the tobacco hornworm. And the differences are minute. It's basically the number of spots on the side and then on the adult. And normally, naturally, in many parts of the country, they feed on weeds like Jimson weed and other plants in the Solanaceae. And a big clump of weeds, or a very large plant, can maintain multiple caterpillars. But on a tomato plant in the garden, it's unlikely that a single tomato plant can sustain the biomass involved in more than one caterpillar.
Well, this guy was defoliating several plants in a row, but I wondered if it was him traveling back and forth or does he have neighbors that I'm going to have to search for.
Oh, I would search, but again, it's because of their enormous size and the relative lack of, compared to some other hosts, leaf tissue in a tomato plant. There probably are others you should look for. But
okay, well, good. Thank you. I won't take up much more time.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll go on here. Let's go back here to Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello, May.
Hey there.
And David.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had emailed a message in, and I didn't know if you guys saw that or not, but my call was in regard to the parks, the Champaign Park District, taking down the bee tree this last week in Clark Park. And my bees were annihilated by that disaster. And I was wondering, my question was had several questions, if that's going to impact the ability of queens to mate this fall, if there's likely to be enough of a drone population, if this one event is going to have a significant effect on the genetic diversity of our local bee population, and is this affecting, or is it likely to affect your bee study there at the university?
Well, we had also received notice of this incident. It's kind of surprising, actually. I think it was
very surprising.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was the city or the park district.
Park district.
That really there was no necessity to kill, particularly using pesticides, to kill the bees. In general, we have worked well in the past. This is by we, I should say, Dr. Gene Robinson is head of the bee research facility here, and we work with local beekeepers in order to capture swarms and to collect colonies and move them. I mean, people are undoubtedly aware of the sad state of feral bees across the country. They are beset, as it were, beset by problems, and really pose very, I can understand, you know, liability issues and the like, but they really don't present that much of a risk.
No.
So it was surprising and really kind of disappointing and unnecessary in terms of its impact on local population. It's really hard to assess because even here in this very bee-savvy community, we don't have a good grasp of how many feral bees there are. Okay. The university has bees all over the place. Just as a kind of a, you don't all put all your eggs in one basket, among other things.
Right.
And interestingly, our hives for the first time are I hope it's all right if I, Gene, I hope it's all right if I announce this on the radio, but we have a small hive beetle now. This is another pest of bees.
I discovered it yesterday also.
Yeah. So this is one of the many, many, many plagues afflicting managed honeybee colonies and undoubtedly feral colonies. It's a little, it's called a nidodulid sap beetle that's accidentally introduced from Africa, and it wreaks havoc with honeybee colonies. And we found it in our colonies. So it would be difficult to project a greater impact based on this one pesticide kill. It's not great, but how extensive the damage is really hard to say.
Yeah.
But as an awareness-raising event, it's really important. There's been a sea change, I guess, or a bee change in the landscape, where 10 years ago the calls we got invariably about bees were, there's bees in a tree in my yard, how do I get rid of them? The vast majority now are, there are bees in my yard, how can I help them? How can I move them? How can I help them and save them? So
right.
A little disappointing when our own park district is intent on taking a, you know,
diversity.
Yeah. So anyway, we're apprised of this, also kind of disappointed, and hope to work with them in the future to, reduce the impact on not only Park District bees, but on neighboring bees as well.
Well, I was disappointed as well because they were, from the outset, well, at first they denied that they were even involved in the poisoning of the bees. And then we had a neighbor that actually saw the person spraying. So
yikes.
We knew someone had done it. And then we were able to identify that person, and he was willing to admit, you know, exactly what had happened, and was paid by the park district to do it. So at that point, we knew exactly what was going on. But it is unfortunate. It's discouraging when you have ignorant people that are making decisions like that. And I have to lay it to ignorance, because people don't deliberately try and harm people or to cause harm. But in this day and age with bees, there should be a counterintuitive, or there should be an intuitive force that says, well, you know, bees need a break. And it's not something that, like you said, you expect to see, but when you do see it, it's very disappointing.
It's not just that bees need a break. We need pollinators.
And we do.
Frankly,
exactly.
You know, honeybees are the essentially only managed pollinators that we can rely on. So
right.
It's not a good thing when we – it's the easy fix is to kill them all, but in the long run, that's kind of self-destructive. So.
Had you seen much of a decline in the drones in your colonies, or are you in a position to know that?
Because interesting. I have a student who's actually waiting for drones. She's doing a project. She's trying to compare metabolism, and there was a at least a momentary drone shortage. But
I think so.
I can't really speak for the rest of the U of I bee herd.
Right. Well, I know for sure in this neighborhood there's a definite decrease in the population. And I think that it's hard to know if this was the cause or if it's something else, but that will certainly affect the ability of queens to mate this fall if you're actually trying to rear some queens to carry you through the winter. So that's an important factor also, because, you know, a good strong queen is very necessary to maintain the colony.
And a lot of people have had success with breeding their own queen.
Oh, exactly.
To encourage local adaptation and resistance to the various stressors. So it doesn't help when the drones aren't available.
Yeah, that's something that's easy to learn how to do. So everybody should be doing that themselves. Very easy to learn.
Yeah, well, more people. Apropos of that, maybe I can put in a plug for
sure.
Our upcoming.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a the Pollinatarium is a university run sort of science center devoted to pollinators, including honeybees. And as a fundraiser, next month we will be coming out with a cookbook with honey recipes. It's called Honey, I'm Homemade. Sweet treats from the beehive from around the world and across the years, and all the proceeds go to the planetarium.
Oh,
and part of the motivation behind a honey cookbook is to encourage people to buy local honey.
Exactly.
Which encourages local beekeepers. So.
Exactly. Well, I'm not a person that sells my honey. I give it to my friends and family and try and share it when I have it. And I'm glad that you addressed this issue today. Hopefully people have learned their lesson and it won't happen again. But
I think awareness raising is a big part of it.
It's unfortunate. They claim that the beekeepers haven't been responsive to helping them when they've asked. Now, anybody that I've talked to is just the direct opposite. I mean, most of these people are pretty frugal, and they're willing to take a colony almost any time they can get one. I mean,
we taught our beekeeping course for the first time in 30 years this summer, and the instructor actually had trouble finding bees to start colonies because they were in short supply. So.
Right. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
I appreciate it.
And again, I'm glad you mentioned that because now if, you know, maybe next year, if there are more people around, people who are listening to us who are thinking about getting into beekeeping, there is a course that they can take, and I guess that would tell them everything that they need to know about how to do it, right?
Yeah, it's not just a how-to, but also the basic biology of honeybees, which is absolutely fascinating. They are not like other insects. I mean, I know a lot about a lot of insects, but bees, I could believe, are like aliens from another planet. Don't tell my colleagues I actually said that, but they are just so different, and at least in part because of their amazing social life.
Uh-huh. Sounds like there's a bad movie there somewhere.
Oh, I've seen a lot of those. Actually, I was previewing films for the 28th Insect Fear Film Festival, trying to come up with a theme, and we may be looking at a wasp fear film festival this year.
So. All right. Stay tuned. May Barenbaum is our guest. She is head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I, a scientist who specializes in studying insects, and occasionally is here on the program, and we talk about them, not extermination stuff. We did that. We've done that. But other kinds of questions, if you want to engage your curiosity, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu, and let's talk with someone in Mattoon, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've lived out at Lake Mattoon for about 14 years now, and this year is the first year I've seen the most beautiful insect. When I get up in the morning, it's on the siding wall next to the nightlight. It's absolutely snow white. All of it. It's absolutely white. And it reminds me of a moth, its shell or its wings.
Yeah. Oh, so you want to know what it is?
Yeah.
Almost assuredly, what you're describing is it's called Spilosoma virginica. It's the Virginia tiger moth. And you know what a woolly bear is?
Yeah.
That's what woolly bears turn into. There are a bunch of different species of woolly bears, but one of the woolly bears turns into that beautiful snow-white moth. Sometimes there's little black marks, but this year we seem to be having a really good year for woolly bears, yellow woolly bears. They're the ones that ultimately turn into that white moth. They're sort of, they look kind of like you could pet them.
Almost, yeah, they're almost as cereal. I was trying to get all the silly little dead ants off, and I hit it, and I felt so bad. I mean, for the first time in my life, I have an appreciation for insects, because it is so beautiful.
Yeah, the woolly bears in the immature stages are pretty generalized feeders. They feed on just about any kind of forbs and vegetables and the like, and you know they're called woolly bears because they're just covered with hairs, and ultimately turn into those snow white moths that for some reason are among the contingent of moths that find porch lights irresistible.
But why are they pure white? I mean, it doesn't seem very adaptive to me.
The woolly bears are...
Unless it likes siding, my siding.
Woolly bears are interesting. This particular species hasn't been studied in this respect. It's unlikely that it is... the woolly bears in general are able to store or sequester poisons from some of the plants they eat. So many of the, they're called, the yellow woolly bear's other name is Virginia tiger moth. It doesn't look very tiger-like because it's not striped, but many of the other species in this family are orange, white, and black striped. Very striking. And it's called warning coloration, just like when you yield signs or highway hazard signs are orange and black. So are hazardous insects. Generally, most birds don't like hairy caterpillars to begin with, so they're defended in their immature stages. And then when they become adults, a lot of them have the capacity to store poisons from the food they eat and ultimately are protected. Whether these white guys are protected or not is not likely, but their relatives with the orange and black stripes almost certainly are.
Well, thank you very much.
All right,
thank you for appreciating it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, let's go to Kankakee, line 4. Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about cicada killers. I have a pod of, or I don't know what you call them, a group of them that nest outside or alongside my deck underneath some sandstones and in the flowers next to the sidewalk. They are just absolutely wonderful to watch. They buzz around and cause my German Shorthaired Pointer no end of ill because he can't catch them or she can't catch them rather. You know, but they come in the middle of June and there are two different sizes and they produce the most incredible holes in the ground with very finely ground dirt and they'll kill cicadas and come flying into the hole with the cicadas. Do they store that food and then lay eggs? Because they're all gone now.
Exactly. In fact, if you've ever heard a cicada in August sort of trilling and then it suddenly trails off, that's probably a victim.
They got one. They're in the trees. The cicadas are in the trees all the time. I mean, in the summertime, but then they come in. And they're wonderful to watch. I just love them.
You know? Yeah, well, you're in the minority because a lot of people are terrified of them because they are the biggest wasp in eastern North America. But
they
won't
hurt
you.
Yeah, won't hurt you.
And in fact, the ones you see flying around, flying in your face, are the males. And the males actually are defending territories because that's how they gain access.
Are they the smaller or the larger?
The smaller, yeah.
Okay, so the females are the large ones.
Well, the females, too, they're large, but it's hard to underestimate or to under these guys are amazing. If you think of what a cicada killer has to do, yeah, they're big wasps, but they're hunting cicadas. It's like if Buffalo Bill went out there and killed a buffalo and slung it over his shoulder and carried it home. The relative size of a cicada killer and a cicada, they're flying. They're not, I mean, Buffalo Bill could, like, take the train, but these guys are in the air.
In the air.
And
with
it's
something that weighs two,
as much as they do, or more.
Yeah, at least as much as they do, or more than they do.
And that's one reason the venom is paralytic and fast acting, so at least the cicada isn't kicking and struggling. What they do is they basically fly mostly downhill because it's a lot easier than getting lift.
Right.
So they'll go from one point to a lower point to a lower point, ultimately getting to the ground, dragging these things into the complex burrows they've made, deposit an egg, and then the still living paralyzed cicada is sort of fresh food for the growing grub. So that's what they're doing.
And so the young ones will come out next year?
Right. Yeah, so they'll develop
wonderful.
Up and that's why you only really see them in late summer, and you particularly see them in sandy soils because it's easier for them to make those burrows there.
Right, I see them beginning at the middle of June.
Yeah, that might be a global warming thing because I remember them not being quite so early. Like
global warming. Yeah.
Fireflies in May, I've never seen until recently either. So.
Yeah. Well, we all must adjust.
Well, and thanks for not being afraid of them, because a lot of people are intimidated.
Well, they're wonderful. Great, great entertainment.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
For your program.
And the obviously, you don't need to be worried about the male. Obviously, you don't need to be worried about the males because the males don't sting.
Right.
But what they are, it's just they're defending their territory, and what they want to know, are you another cicada killer? And once they've determined that you're not, they couldn't care less about you. They only want to scare, if you're another male, they want to scare you away. Or if you're a female, they want to mate with you. But if you're neither, they don't care. They'll just go off.
It's actually interesting. A lot of insects have that behavior and will attack humans, but humans don't even realize they're being attacked. The black swallowtail butterfly, for example, engages in this mating behavior called hilltopping, where males come out a few days before the females and head to some sort of area of topographic relief, which is hard in central Illinois, but it could be like a raised rail, railway bed or a grain elevator, and they will basically, it's like a king of the hill scenario. There's one male that occupies the high point and chases off anything else that's black and fluttery. So if you come by with a black bandana, you will be attacked by a male black swallowtail. Most people just think, oh, how charming. Different when it's a an inch and a half long cicada killer, but it's the same phenomenon.
All right. Let's see. Indiana is our next caller. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hello. A couple of things. The first thing, I walked into McDonald's and some of my elderly friends were there, and big discussion was woolly worms. Mm-hmm. No, they go north. No, they go south. No, they go east. No, they go west. And I was like, God, things have changed since I was a kid, because the same story was always told when I was a little boy. But now it's, doesn't mean much to hell of beans anyway. But now it's, whatever the compass points, that's where the woolly worms go, and we're going to have a hell of a winter, or when they're going to have a warm winter. So it's almost 50-50 down the line. Now to the two questions I wanted to ask you about. One is, could you give some characterization of the amount of food intake, let's say a common house spider we might find outside, actually, that it's taking care of a ladybug. How long does that last? I watched this house spider for weeks. And I don't think it moved once, and all of a sudden it caught the ladybug, and of course it moved in, wrapped it up, and did its thing, and now it's back sitting around again. And I was just wondering, I remember as a child I used to wonder about that, never could find it in any books of any type, about just how long one meal lasts, like a spider, or any other thing you may know about. Then the last one is, all of a sudden, I've seen a incredible number of white admiral butterflies bumping into my house all the time. Some of them light on the edges of the house for a brief period of time, then they fly off. But that one time, there must have been 15 or 20 of them flying around my backyard at various heights. And I thought, what is going on? I've seen white admirals, from time to time, but not this many. I was wondering if there's any situations of rain, heat, or whatever, it made a better crop, so to speak, this time. That's all. Glad you're back. I was thinking about you yesterday. I had some questions about. I still wish I'd been an entomologist, but.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Well, let me go in reverse order. The admiral butterflies are abundant this year. Butterflies tend to have these boom and bust cycles in populations. A few years ago, painted ladies were incredibly abundant. Zebra butterflies, years go by and they're almost invisible, and then there's a boom year for zebras. The short answer is nobody is exactly sure why butterflies go in these boom-bust cycles. There are so many probably local explanations for increases that it's hard to come up with one single answer for a general increase. But I agree. I've seen a lot as well this year. Spiders, how often do they eat? It, of course, depends on the species of spiders. But arthropod predators in general have an incredible capacity to withstand starvation. And that's because they do feed on such an unpredictable food resource, that so they are accustomed to long periods without food and can withstand long periods without food. Another thing that spiders as predators are capable of doing is maturing at different sizes. If the food supply is minimal in any particular locality, certain species of spiders will just mature at a much smaller size. And you can get a tenfold range of variation in adult spider size depending on the food supply. So This is particularly true for the sit-and-wait predators, not the active ones that run down and wrestle with their prey. But sit-and-wait predators that don't actively hunt except by where they locate their webs are amazingly able to withstand starvation. So that's just a general pattern. Woolly bears, there are a lot of legends. The oldest legend about the woolly bear is refers to one species in particular, Isia Isabella, the banded woolly bear. And the idea is this is a caterpillar with it's a red band in the middle and black head and tail ends. And the width of the red band is supposed to predict the severity of the winter. And it's... there have been some studies that basically say there's no correlation whatsoever with the weather, although there may be some association with the degree of humidity and the degree of bandedness, and but they're not really good prognosticators of the weather. I got an email once from a lady who knew about the in general, didn't know it was banded woolly bears, but she'd found an entirely gray caterpillar. It was uniform with no band at all, and she was afraid that meant we were in for, like, nuclear winter or something. So it depends. It's only the banded woolly bear that's supposed to predict the weather. And the other phenomenon that you referred to is, do they always cross in the same direction? And I've actually seen some studies, too, to determine whether or not there is a consistent pattern of migration. The caterpillars that cross the road, why did the caterpillar cross the road? Well, usually it's to find an overwintering site. Unlike a lot of lepidopterans, butterflies or moths that spend the winter as pupae, you know, that inert metamorphic stage, the banded woolly bear spends the winter as a caterpillar, an immature caterpillar. So in the spring, you know, so it remains in a dormant state. In the spring, sort of wakes up and completes its caterpillar development and then pupates and emerges. They all seem to be going in the same direction here in central Illinois because probably they've been feeding in soybean fields and are heading out of the soybean fields. So they're all sort of moving in one direction if they all come from the same soybean field. But I wouldn't count on them to predict the weather.
So. All right, very good. I do have this feeling that this summer I've seen more butterflies and more big butterflies than I remember having seen before. In my yard several times this summer, I've seen tiger swallowtail. I had never seen one before. Ah. It's one of the most spectacular things I ever saw, just stunningly beautiful. And I don't remember ever having seen one of those before.
It's been a generally good butterfly year. No butterfly expert I know has any idea why. But that's good for us. I've seen some tigers as well.
Yeah. About 10 minutes left, a little bit more in this hour with Mae Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I, a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And if you have insect questions, not extermination questions now, but appreciation ones, this is the time to call. And we have several people ready to go. We'll go back to the phones and to Spring Bay. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've got a question. We have a lot of milkweed out in the fields, and we're wondering if it's safe to mow them down now or if the monarchs are still feeding on them.
Well, there's, again, a lot of local variation. I'm not sure about monarchs. I know that in the last hour, Phil talked about the milkweed tiger moths, and they're still out there developing. I would wait a little bit longer because I haven't seen – it looks like the fall migration hasn't quite started yet. It's usually early in September when the butterflies in this area start sort of taking wing and flying south to their overwintering site in Mexico. So if you can hold off a little bit, just catch those stragglers. So it would be good.
Sure. Yeah, we can do that. Now, I have a what looks like a hornet's nest on the front porch, and I was wondering if you could give me an idea of when might be a good time to move that and where would be a good location to move it. I was thinking, you know, after the ground freezes and everything, but where should I put it?
Well, there's actually probably not much reason to save a hornet's nest because nobody survives. They're
okay.
Annual colonies, not like the honeybee. There may be – actually, I don't even think the queens remain in the nest. I think they head out and overwinter in under bark or in litter and the like. So after a freeze, it's likely that no one will be home.
Okay.
And then you have a nice souvenir.
Okay. Okay, well, that's what I needed to know. Thank you.
Very good. All right, thank you. Let's see. We'll talk next with somebody in Champaign. Line number two. Hello.
Hi. How can you spot a bed bug in a hotel room? And then what do you do to get rid of bed bugs if you spot them in your house?
Whoa, that's, again, that's a long and complicated thing. But the bed bugs in the hotel, I think I creep out my family because I check. When you go into a hotel, you should look at the mattress and look at the sheets and look at the creases. And telltale signs include sort of accumulated frass, that's
bed
bug excrement.
It's
yeah, right. Blood, little tiny blood stains. You can sometimes even see the bed bugs. Check out the front page at Science Times today. They're not microscopic. It's just that you have to know where to look to find them. It's interesting. I was reading a 1993 version of Metcalf and Metcalf, which is the classic text, destructive and useful insects. And they recommend, back in 93, they recommended sprinkling pyrethrum powder if you're in a hotel room for a night to keep away the bed bugs, at least for one night. I'm pretty sure that most populations of bed bugs are now resistant to pyrethrum powder, which is more likely to be effective than the pyrethrin sprays because that's what's being used globally for eradication, not the flower-derived powder. So getting rid of them is a major operation which involves more than pesticides. It involves steam cleaning and replacing furniture do you know if the Science Times article mentions some of the more effective?
It mentions control. I'm not sure. If you want to go to the web archive and listen to the first hour of the show, Phil went on at some length. Phil Nixon went on some length about controlling bed bugs. I think you have to get a professional insect control person involved, and it can be pretty complicated. So that's sorry to say that there seems to be no easy answer to the problem.
There have been some recent studies showing they are resistant to just about everything that has ever been used on a bed bug before. So.
And that's, I think, also one of the things that Phil said is that there are some bed bugs that will be resistant to everything that you use on bed bugs. So you may use a particular control product and it'll kill some of them, but it won't kill all of them. That's one of the things that makes it so tough to deal with.
Yeah, like that line in the old World War II movies, you may kill me here alone, there will be thousands more to take my place. That's exactly what happens.
I'm really feeling itchy. let's see. We'll get some more callers in here. Piatt County, I think, is our next line for. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
I might have missed this earlier. I just came in. But I noticed, it's been over 2 weeks ago, on my flowers, a little whitish yellow, really pale, tiny caterpillars about half the size of your little finger. And I was just wondering, are those also woolly worms that we used to call woolly worms?
Well, woolly worm is unmistakable because it's fuzzy, it's hairy.
It is fuzzy, fuzzy, but all one color. All different colors.
Well, there's several different species of woolly worms, and the so-called yellow woolly bear, which is kind of a misnomer. It's often all uniform pale yellow, but it can also be white, it can be silvery, it can be, so if it was little a couple of weeks ago, it was probably a yellow woolly worm.
Okay, well, I had just never seen one, so thanks so much.
They're having a good year.
Okay.
There is, by the way, there are at least two woolly worm festivals across the U.S. There's one in upstate Pennsylvania, and there's one in Banner Elk, North Carolina, where they have woolly worm races, which relates to the behavior of these caterpillars and crossing roads, which attracts attention.
Okay. Let's see. We got about 5-6 minutes left, and let's go to line number three in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
I would like to bring something to May's attention, although she may be able to tell me a little bit about it. While I was passing through the center, the public square in front of the church Saint-Maclou in France in Rouen this summer, we saw what was labeled as a bank, B-A-N-Q-U-E, but in fact it was like a sizable shed, and the person who was sort of describing the local activities to us said that it was a public hive, a honeybee hive. So so that people would realize how they were raised. And I thought, oh, my goodness, their park district, and of course I don't know this, put one there. And I thought, you know, I can actually send you, but if you just go to Bing or Google or some such thing, you can put in B-A-N-Q-U-E, do, D-U, M-I-E-L, and it will bring up a few photographs of the public honey bank in front of this ancient church. And I thought, how cool is that?
That is very cool. It has been said that the world's best urban honey is in Paris. There's a long tradition of beekeeping inside the city, and there are so many flowers in, well, not just Paris, but in France, that the honey is considered exquisite. We are very slow to catch up on this tradition. Only last year was beekeeping actually made it legal in New York City. There's been sort of what's it called? Illegal beekeeping, urban beekeeping on rooftops has been going on for a long time, but finally the city recognized that they are not an immediate threat, and actually honey production and pollination benefit everybody, and I guess we have some catching up to do in terms of attitudes about insects. So I will have to check that site out. That sounds great.
Thanks so much.
All right, very good.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. And we'll do one more. And this is someone on a cell phone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. This is a question about spiders.
Okay.
Does that work?
Yeah, sure. They're not insects.
They're not insects, but that's
open-minded.
Right. We've been seeing spider webs that are out in the yard that are in the middle of an open space, very far from a tree or trees on the edges where they seem to be anchored. I don't understand how they get the web up there. Can you explain that?
Well, that's probably there are a couple of spiders that do that. The garden spider is one. I mean, that's what it's officially called. And it is a marvel of engineering. They do have this initial drag line that, a frame line, I guess, which they'll string for up to 10 feet. And they can, to some degree, just gravity helps them move ballooning, although the big spiders aren't quite as capable. Ballooning is when you send out a little silk thread and it carries you off. But that's the first step in making a web, is to sort of set down the anchor lines. And they can be, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 feet long. And it looks like they're just suspended in the middle of nothing, and that's very effective if you're trying to intercept flying, unsuspecting creatures.
Do they come down out of one tree and crawl over to another and then go up?
That initial thread, I think, is more of a free fall than sort of a piecemeal kind of effort. The garden spider, or the yellow and black argiope, is one of the ones that does this. The Nephila spiders in the southeastern U.S. make webs that are literally 10 feet across, and they catch humans because don't expect to see them there. One thing to look for, they're called stabilimenta. They're little zigzag. I don't know if you've seen those. Little zigzag, denser silk, which makes them more visible.
Right.
This is, some people believe that the stabilimenta are not to stabilize the web, but are actually to alert birds to the presence of the web, so that birds don't keep flying through and breaking the, an enormous expenditure of resources and time for a spider to have to keep replacing a web is not a good thing. But, there's actually some YouTube videos. You can see how that first anchor line is laid down. So if you do a search on garden spider on YouTube, you might end up finding one of those.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have actually worked through all calls. Something you want to talk about?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on the very first call about the tobacco hornworm. What I didn't address is, the tobacco hornworms do not are not gregarious. The females lay only single eggs, and they lay eggs individually on foliage. Doesn't mean that there won't be more than one caterpillar on a plant, but they are not gregarious caterpillars like some species are, right? Painted ladies and the like, where you'll see a mass of caterpillars. But if there are multiple caterpillars, it's because there are multiple ovoposition or egg-laying events. Mm-hmm. So just a clarification.
Will there be things going on in the planetarium throughout the wintertime?
Absolutely. Well, we're going to have a cookbook launch.
Honey book?
And it'll be a honey tasting as well. So that's something that maybe you guys can help us publicize that. In fact, one of my former students is now in France, and she just sent me a sampler of French honeys we were talking about earlier. Chestnut honey, which we don't have much of here since we don't have many chestnuts, and lavender honey, which is really quite good, and locust honey, robinia, acacia honey. It's almost white, clear. It's really a magnificent honey. So one of the points of the cookbook is that honey is not one homogeneous uniform substance like, you know, Cairo syrup. It's every honey is different. And the same hive in the spring and the summer will produce different flavors and different colors of honey. So
I guess that's something that I really never appreciated until, well, actually maybe a few years ago, where I started trying different honeys. And depending on what sort of pollen the bees have gotten the quality of the honey will be different. Myself, I'm rather partial to Tupelo, which I think is really, really nice. That has a cinnamon thing.
Yeah, Tupelo is highly prized, and it is the only certified varietal honey. The only way you get Tupelo honey is there's a 2-week flowering period in the southeastern U.S. and in swampy areas. It's the Tupelo tree, Nyssa aquatica. And it's really very difficult. The beekeepers have to move their colonies to these swamps and have to know where they are. And then, it's magnificent honey. It doesn't crystallize like some honeys because of the sugar composition of the nectar. And if you're interested in how Tupelo honey is made, rent Yuli's Gold, which was a wonderful movie made, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, about the incidentally about the life of a Tupelo producing honey. Beekeeper.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much for being
thank
here.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology here at the University of Illinois. Look for her books in the bookstore or the library near you.